But he, as he looks around and takes pictures, he can't really see any evidence of rocket-propelled grenade attacks. And what he's seeing in terms of bullet holes isn't really consistent with Somali pirates firing their rifles from a skiff alongside. So, you know, he definitely isn't quite sure what he's looking at, but he's fairly sure it isn't anything to do with pirates.
This is Preble Hall. Welcome to Preble Hall, a podcast about naval history from the United States Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis.
This is Stephen Phillips. I have the deck and the con for today's podcast. Today, my guest is Kit Shalell to discuss his book, Dead in the Water. Co-written with Matthew Campbell and published by Portfolio, it is the story of the aging oil tanker, motor vessel Brillante Virtuoso, corruption, and murder. It highlights an important part of maritime history facing the global economy and the challenges of multiple elements operating at sea. Kit Shalell is a reporter and writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. He has won numerous international prizes for his work, covering everything from Chinese state hackers and feuding hedge funds to shady Nigerian oil deals and Irish sectarian gangsters. Kit, welcome to Preble Hall.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve.
On the morning of July 6, 2011, the USS Philippine Sea was steaming in the Gulf of Aden. Part of a coalition of warships conducting anti-piracy operations near the Horn of Africa, her crew heard a distress call from motor vessel Brillante Virtuoso. The oil tanker was attacked by pirates during the previous night and was on fire. Philippine Sea raced to rescue the 26 Filipino sailors that abandoned their burning ship. The U.S. Navy did not encounter any pirates. Normally, this would be the most exciting part of the story. However, the investigation that followed highlights aspects of the global maritime environs that Preble Hall listeners will find fascinating. Kit, let's start with the ship. Describe Brillante Virtuoso, her crew, and mission.
The Brillante Virtuoso was a Suezmax oil tanker. It was carrying about a million barrels of oil, which was being transported from Ukraine to China. Her crew were all Filipino, including the captain and chief engineer. And they were roughly halfway through their voyage. They'd just passed through the Suez Canal.
So they're transporting oil to China from Ukraine, passing through the Suez Canal. Seems like it's a pretty simple approach, right? Like, so it's like what, Royal Dutch Shell selling oil to China?
It wasn't exactly Royal Dutch Shell, no. This was one of those oil deals that's sort of on the fringes of that mainstream part of the industry. It was an international oil trading group based in Switzerland called Holt Global, and they're doing the relatively unusual trade of Ukrainian oil to China. It's not a, that's not sort of the bread and butter of the oil industry, but of course oil traders exist to, you know, find profitable deals wherever they can, and I guess this was one they found and thought was good to go.
So those who've been to sea may recognize that ships are often flagged under a country of convenience. They're sometimes owned by another country. I did not realize in reading Dead in the Water how many layers of ownership and management's involved. So they're going through the Gulf of Aden, and the combination of all these owners and managers knew that that region was dangerous. Many in the U.S. public, of course, know the story of Captain Phillips and the Maersk Alabama. What happens to ships when they're captured by pirates around the Horn of Africa?
So the period we're talking about now is 2011. It's kind of peak Somalian piracy. There's an attack or an attempted attack once every couple of days. And actually, the film Captain Phillips does a pretty reasonable job of showing how those attacks unfold. It's a small vessel, a skiff normally, like a little motorboat that is coming from Somalia or some stopover point nearby. And they're just patrolling, looking for a big prize, any big prize they can get. The bigger the ship, the more valuable the prize. And so back then, they would board using grappling hooks and scale the side of the ship. The ship obviously has to sort of do defensive measures, as in the film, you know, blasting the attackers with water, or, you know, accelerating to maximum speed, any sort of defensive measures they can. So it's this incredible battle. And if the pirates are successful and they manage to board the ship, they can wave their guns around and pretty quickly they can take control.
I've heard stories where companies are willing to pay the ransom for the ship and the crew, in part because only in the period of time of waiting, the value of the cargo increases or decreases. So it's almost more worth their while economically to pay it off than it is to try to deal with it in another way. So knowing this danger, what procedures did the crew of Brillante Virtuoso and their managers, what did they put in place to protect themselves?
It's fair to say the Brillante and its crew did some of the measures you would expect to be passing through this dangerous area. They ran a razor wire around the extremities of the ship to make it much more difficult to scale it and climb over the side. They made sure that there was a safe zone inside the ship called a citadel, I think it was, which is a lockable area stocked with food and water where they can sort of hide if pirates manage to get aboard. I think they even may have done this trick where they get a mannequin and dress it up in seafarer's clothing and post it on the bridge to look like there's someone on watch, even if there is no one on watch. And it was definitely at the forefront of everyone's mind. We've got audio from the ship of the Filipino guys talking about pirates, joking about ships they see going past, you know, talking about what might happen if pirates manage to get aboard. It's definitely on everyone's mind. But the ship does a rather foolish thing, which is to stop in the most dangerous area imaginable and just wait. They were waiting for a security crew to come, but it's not an area you want to linger in. The longer you're there, the higher the risk of something bad happening.
When the crew is rescued then, what did they tell the sailors aboard Philippine Sea about what transpired?
The crew told this bizarre story of armed men appearing alongside the Brillante Virtuoso, claiming to be security personnel. And then when they arrived on the ship, they, number one, were clearly not Somalian. They were speaking Arabic and they were light-skinned. And they also behaved somewhat oddly in that they locked the crew inside the television room, posting armed guards outside. And then they went off and had an interaction with the captain and the master. And the Brillante starts to move in the middle of the night. And then there's a big explosion. Suddenly it stops. And smoke starts pouring into the television room. The crew are absolutely terrified. They have no idea what's happening. And they come out to find the pirates have gone. The captain's tied up. And the order pretty quickly after that is, we've got to abandon ship. You know, we're on 100 million barrels of oil. The ship is burning, spewing smoke into the sky. And then that's when the USS Philippine Sea arrives and gets everyone on board.
I think this is where Captain David Mockett enters the story. First, who was he and how did he find himself living in Aden?
Captain David Mockett was an English maritime expert. He'd spent a lifetime working in the merchant navy. And then when he got his captain's certificate, he moved on to get a job in one of the ports in the Middle East. And from then on, his job became sort of land-based. He was one of those army of people whose job it is to inspect ships and cargo wherever they might be passing through. So it sounds like quite an interesting, varied job. You know, his job could be going to inspect a pier that's had a collision with a ship to see what the damage is. It could be that there's reports of damaged steel rebar that the insurers or someone wants him to go and inspect. And his job is to go see for himself with his own two eyes and write a report to send back to London or New York or Piraeus or whatever it is to make sure that everything's in order.
So then he was asked to go out and inspect Brillante Virtuoso after this piracy event, after this fire. What did he find when he visited the ship?
Yeah, David Mockett, he's basically one of only about two or three people in the entire country of Yemen who was qualified to go and inspect a damaged oil tanker. And it's a tricky business. You know, he has to find his way out there on a fishing ship, on a little fishing boat. He has to persuade the salvage crew to let him aboard. You know, that it's heavy seas, it's quite dangerous conditions. But he manages to do it. It's his job. He's good at it. He's been doing it an awful long time. But when he goes aboard the ship, he finds an extraordinary amount of fire damage. It's in very bad shape. The bridge has been completely destroyed. Everything's twisted and warped by the heat. The fire seems to be out, but the vessel is still hot from the fire. And what he's there to do is, you know, to find out whether the ship can potentially be salvaged or whether it's a write-off. And also to examine the story that we've been told, which is that pirates did this. Pirates boarded the vessel, fired their guns, and that maybe a rocket-propelled grenade was fired, which started this mysterious fire. But as he looks around and takes pictures, he can't really see any evidence of rocket-propelled grenade attacks. And what he's seeing in terms of bullet holes isn't really consistent with Somali pirates firing their rifles from a skiff alongside. So, you know, he definitely isn't quite sure what he's looking at, but he's fairly sure it isn't anything to do with pirates.
As you and Matthew described David as a person, combined with his professionalism, I imagined that he is someone I would very much like to meet. Unfortunately, that cannot be. What happened to David?
David Mockitz is back in Aden a few days after boarding the vessel and inspecting it and taking photographs. And he's in the middle of the process of unraveling what's happening. Obviously, there's a huge amount of money invested in this ship and its voyage, something like $100 million worth of oil. The ship is insured itself for maybe $50 million plus. These are huge sums of money. And everyone back in London is waiting for his report. So he sends back some updates. He collates and gathers all his photographs. He talks to some of his friends who are also experts in maritime matters. And he starts to put together a report that he can send back to update everyone as to what's going on. Now, he manages to send, one or two emails with details about the attack and his initial assessments. And he's telling people that he needs to find out more. There are still questions that he hasn't been able to answer. But he's a well-connected man in Aden. Everyone seems to know him. So he's got a good chance of actually getting to the bottom of it. Unfortunately, only a few days after coming back from the vessel, he's driving his Lexus home from work. And a car bomb that's been meticulously placed under his seat is detonated and kills him almost instantly.
Now, Yemen at the time was a place that had civil war, right? There was strife. And so there are some that suggest that that might have been the cause.
Yeah, actually, immediately after the death, pretty much everyone was saying that the chances are that David Mockitz was killed by Islamic terrorists or extremists in Yemen. Yemen has always been kind of a breeding ground for Islamic terror. Al-Qaeda used to have a significant presence there, but it's not just Al-Qaeda. There are countless other similar groups that have been known to sort of kidnap or murder Westerners. You know, in some ways, it was a logical explanation for a seemingly random attack on a British citizen in Aden. In fact, the local press was reporting it as being Al-Qaeda or similar terror group related. But there were a few things about the attack that made it not much like other terrorist attacks that have been seen.
I knew from the jacket cover of Dead in the Water that David was murdered. After I read this section in the book, I suspected the two investigators were motivated by seeking justice for David and his family. Is this also the case for you and Matthew as authors of Dead in the Water?
Absolutely. When I very first heard about this ship, it was before there'd been a court case, before there'd been any real awareness of what had happened. It was in the very early days, back in 2016. And the thing that elevated it for me and made it more than just a sort of inexplicable, mysterious maritime event was the murder of David Mockitz. And the fact that no one knew what had happened to him. No one had good answers for his family who'd been left behind without their father, their grandfather. But for me and Matt, as journalists, you know, the mystery of his death not only gave it sort of a very real human impact. This wasn't just things happening out at sea. You know, this is a really good man who left behind a family. And also the fact that there'd never been any reckoning for what happened. No one had been arrested or thrown in jail or even really accused of the murder. It just happened and been forgotten about. And Matt and I, you know, found that quite upsetting.
Indeed. So then please introduce to the Preble Hall audience the two investigators, the former London Metropolitan Police officers that began to delve into this case.
So I should say, first of all, David Mockett, you know, marine surveyor, is the first step for any type of shipping casualty, just to get eyes on board, take some pictures, you know, put them into evidence. But if you're looking to go deeper, if you still don't have the answers you need as a trader or a merchant or insurance company, you know, you're going to need professional investigators to try and get as much information as they can. And that was exactly what was required in this case. The insurers needed answers. And so they hired these two guys out of London, both experienced former Metropolitan Police detectives. They'd spent their lifetimes chasing around organized criminals, Turkish heroin gangs, all sorts of large-scale criminality. So they had the skill set required. One of them is called Richard Veal. He's an expert at forensic accounting and tracing assets. And his colleague and old friend is Michael Connor, who's a former amateur boxer with the nickname Metal Mickey. And his real skill set is dealing with criminals face-to-face. He's a tough guy. He's completely fearless. And he'll put himself in any situation without a second thought to get the answers he needs. So in a way, you couldn't really ask for two more well-qualified investigators to take on this job.
The evidence suggests foul play, fraud, and now murder. And the owner becomes a suspect. Let's delve into Marios Iliopoulos in more detail. Who is he and how did he get into the shipping business?
So Marios Iliopoulos is a Greek shipping tycoon, I guess you could call him. He's one of these Greek family-run businesses who owns a dozen or so shipping, either container ships or oil tankers, and operates that fleet doing journeys, carrying cargo around the world. Obviously, you know, the Greeks are still the dominant force in world shipping, and have been for a long, long time, going way back to the 60s and 1960s and beyond. They have this astonishing ability to operate profitably in the most difficult conditions imaginable in shipping, and they're still doing it today. But he's a relatively latecomer to the scene. His dad, I think, was a gold trader who was one of the sort of new generation of Greek shipping businessmen who joined the business when it became really profitable in the 1960s and 70s. So they're a new shipping family. Marios Iliopoulos is one of three brothers, and they sort of inherit the business from their father. But initially in his youth, Marios is much more interested in racing fast cars and motorbikes than he is in a life at sea. The local press called him Super Mario. He's famous for, you know, gunning rally cars around the hills of Greece at 150 miles an hour. And it's only as he gets older that he starts to become a presence in this family business. But by the time you reach the stage of the Brillante Virtuoso incident, he's the main man in terms of his family's business. And in fact, he also runs a company called SeaJets, which is the main passenger ferry line that goes between this and the Holiday Islands.
But Iliopoulos was not on board when the events occurred, but another Greek citizen by the name of Plakakis is. How did he end up there?
Plakakis was another maritime professional. He was a trained accountant, and he finds himself in the Middle East looking for a job, basically, and is introduced to a bunch of Greek businessmen who are starting a venture in Yemen. And so he joins them. And, you know, almost just by random luck, he finds himself in Aden and befriends another Greek expat called Vasilios Virgos, who runs a salvage business there, rescuing and repairing ships around the port of Aden. And so he sort of falls in with this crowd. And when the Brillante Virtuoso is attacked, Plakakis is there, and he ends up, you know, joining the salvage crew for this big operation to rescue a burning oil tanker off the coast of Aden.
And what did Plakakis say occurred?
I mean, I don't want to give away too much of what happens in the book, but it's fair to say that Plakakis unfortunately finds himself as a first-hand witness to this remarkable, chaotic criminal conspiracy where, you know, a bunch of guys sit around and plan this elaborate fraud, and then it sort of plays out right in front of his eyes. he's kind of a reluctant participant in some ways. He doesn't really want to be there. And he's very, very conscious that, you know, he's putting himself at risk by being party to these events. But, you know, he's stuck in Aden. It's not an easy place to leave. He feels like he has no choice. And so what he watches happen is this a remarkable sequence of events that form the basis of the book. And then afterwards, you know, he finds that he's witnessed a crime, and he's in big trouble. You know, he feels like his life is potentially at risk. He feels like the people who are behind the fraudulent enterprise might try and hurt him. He's desperate to get out of it as best he can.
The conglomeration of banks and insurance companies then battle it out for years. What happened to the claims for the cargo, for the oil?
This is an interesting question. You know, the Brillante Virtuoso and its voyage are not particularly unusual by the standards of modern shipping, which is to say that it's enormously complicated. The oil cargo, 100 billion barrels of oil, is potentially owned by two different trading parties who are buying and selling it. Then you've got the interest in the vessel itself, which, you know, is said to be worth in the region of $50 million. You've got the insurance companies, the lending banks. You know, you've got a dozen different financial interests who have something to say about the fate of the Brillante Virtuoso. So as often happens in any complicated maritime disputes, it ends up as a lawsuit, and not just one lawsuit, but multiple lawsuits as well. Talking specifically about the oil cargo, which is obviously probably the most valuable thing, the first priority for everyone involved is to tow the Brillante Virtuoso into safer waters, and then do a ship-to-ship transfer to try and get the oil off, which they managed to do successfully. But obviously that process is difficult and technically challenging, and the salvage crew that do it expect to be paid for their efforts. And so the way it works in salvage is, you know, you take, as a salvage crew, you take on the job and you expect to be rewarded a certain percentage of the value of the cargo. So the salvage crew, the Greek salvage crew who do the ship-to-ship transfer and who tow the vessel away, they're now claiming sort of $35 million in compensation for their work, and that has to be paid. So you've got insurers on the hook for a lot of money. And then, of course, when, you know, David Mockett's reports and the two London detectives start discovering that, you know, this is a suspicious incident, it probably wasn't pirates, there's something else going on, it may well be insurance fraud, then the insurers are reluctant to pay. And so what you end up with is this remarkable 10-year legal dispute in the courts in London that goes on and on and gets more and more hostile.
And what happened to the investigation of the owner, Iliopoulos?
Well, I had the pure good luck to be in court the day he arrived in London to give testimony in the court case. I had no idea he was going to be there. I just happened to see the name of the ship on the court lists. And I showed up not knowing what to expect and walked into this room that had maybe 50 attorneys in total, a very strange, heavy atmosphere where everyone was seemingly very nervous and tense. And then in walks this big, unshaven guy with an untucked shirt, speaking in Greek. And it turns out that he's the owner of the ship. And so I watched this remarkable scene where he's being questioned by attorneys for the insurers, and he's being challenged and accused of things. And he reacts incredibly angrily. He's jabbing his finger. He actually threatens one of the lawyers for the insurers, which I've never seen happen in an English courtroom. And I've been visiting them for 10 odd years. And at the end of all this, he walked out of the courts onto a street in London and was promptly arrested by two City of London police detectives and put in the back of an unmarked car.
Well, did the late David Mockett and his family receive justice?
That's a big question, and it's a really hard one to answer, because I don't know what justice looks like for David Mockett and his family at this particular moment. And I'm not even sure I know what justice looks like in the context of $100 million insurance fraud involving an oil tanker off the coast of Yemen. What ended up happening was this strange kind of stalemate where no one is charged with the murder of David Mockett. The perpetrators of that crime have never been found. Lots of people have theories about what happened to him. His family are still fighting for justice. They have a local politician who's working on their behalf and is trying to get the police to investigate. But because it's a maritime case, because the incidents took place a decade ago, you know, off the coast of an incredibly lawless country, there seems to be this paralysis, this stasis that people are finding it very difficult to escape from. And so, you know, what Matt and I tried to do with Dead in the Water is set out in as much detail as we could these strange events and the various attempts to unravel these crimes and present all the evidence we can. And I think readers, once they read the book, will have their own ideas about what happened to David Mockett and what happened to the ship and can make up their own minds.
Indeed. Kit, what are you working on now?
Well, right now, you know, a lot of my time is spent talking about Dead in the Water. I'm still employed by Bloomberg. I recently, for them, traveled to Egypt and wrote a story about the Ever Given and its 6 days blocking the Suez Canal, and had a remarkable experience out there, learning all about how those events unfolded. And obviously, I'm still, having spent the last 5 years looking at ships and shipping, I find it more intriguing and fascinating than ever, and I'm sure I'll return to it at some point.
Indeed. For the Preble Hall audience, let me say that I recommend this book. Kit and I have covered the highlights in our discussion today, but there are many layers to this story. Anyone interested in the maritime environs and naval history should read this book. I'll leave a link to it in the show notes. Kit, thank you for joining me today on Preble Hall to discuss Dead in the Water.
Thanks so much, Steve. It's been great to talk to you about it. And I hope your readers get a chance to enjoy the book.
Preble Hall is in no way intended to reflect the official positions of the Department of the Navy or the Naval Academy.